Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I am your host, Scott Poley.
And I am Tom Costura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for June 17, 2025. But yeah, before we jump into that, you know, I figured it'd be a good mention. You know, I think we always try to talk about anything that could be groundbreaking or changing. For people in general. And obviously, more recently, we have another conflict to kind of bring up, and people aren't paying attention to major headlines, you know, with the Israel-Iran stuff going out there. I don't know if you've been paying too much attention to it, Tom, but yeah, I feel like that's going to bring some yet more activity that we're probably not used to seeing.
Yeah, you know, it's a crazy world we're living in right now, and it seems to be feeling more and more like, you know, everybody's on the brink. And, you know, we've seen historically with different conflicts, you know, I mean, even recently and still ongoing with the Russia and Ukraine conflict, a lot of different types of things can uptick. You know, they stay safe out there, stay vigilant. And I think that's the first time I've ever effectively wanted to use that term. But yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of, from a cyber defender side of the house, and my perspective, just a couple points, you know, stay close to your intel, understand things that could happen. You know, typically in times like this, you'll see a lot of possibilities. You know, there are nation states involved. There's, you know, absolutely APT groups out there that are associated with these nation states that are in conflict. And I think even beyond that, you know, there's probably a good, you know, a point towards the activism side, you know, of things. But you know, for the most part, it's stay attached to your intel right now and make sure that you're you know, ready to react, respond when you can, because it's getting weird out there, Scott.
Yeah, I would say it'd be a good time to, if you had good I guess relationships with your communication people or folks, just try to make sure you don't put yourself in the mix of all that by trying to publicly make statements or pick sides, just because that could help lead to just annoying, disrupting activity that could be pointed your way. So, you know, sometimes it's best to just kind of sit on the sidelines and then just pay attention to like what you were saying. So there's that from just the preemptive cyber approach. So what do you got for us as far as we're going to discuss this week?
Yeah, so we'll kick it off with, you know, in our direction of normal topics. I have an article from Checkpoint Security titled From Trust to Threat, Hijacked Discord Invites Used for Multi-Staged Malware Delivery. So attackers hijack, you know, basically a basic overview of this. Attackers are able to hijack expired or deleted Discord invite links. And these are both different kinds of links. So both the vanity, which are like the custom links, like the tier 3 level links that you can send out, and standard invite links, and they could use these expired links to redirect users to malicious servers. And visitors would trust these links. Obviously, it's kind of crosses that trust barrier, because I think they were thought to not be able to be reused. And, you know, they're posted in forums or in different places and are assumed to be safe. And in reality, they're ended up leading them to a threat actor controlled server. So what would happen in some of these attacks through Checkpoint's research is when a malicious invite was used, only a verified channel on that malicious server was seen, and it had a safeguard bot, put safeguard in quotes, guiding users to authorize and visit a phishing domain. So in this case, in some of the IOCs they had here, it was a captchaguard.me. And, you know, this is not directionally to beat on this, but I'm sorry, everyone. We live in this world now where click fix is just a thing.
No.
But it spun up a click fix approach, a click fix technique. You know, it would show a broken captcha and then it would prompt the user to manually run the PowerShell command using the Windows run shortcut. And it took and copied JavaScript to the clipboard, just like we always see. And then it would, you know, go through that process. One of the things that was interesting, though, is the click fix was served up and it kind of held, when you've seen the evidence in this article, it held to that, you know, believe me, I'm safe thing, because it kind of was in like a Discord backdrop and it looked like it was legit, you know, the backdrop to the ClickFix thing, I still don't understand how it could be considered legit, but it is meaty. But then that would lead to a multi-stage payload delivery. So you would get a Pastebin hosted PowerShell. So it would download and execute a C++ loader, and it would also use a public GitHub. So this would, you know, kind of help blend in as normal activity, help avoid any type of blocking you might have, like proxy detections, things like that. And then your stage two downloader would be chock full of junk code, obfuscated strings, but it did do a couple things. So it actually would check and require that a specific argument was set to move forward. Otherwise, it would just exit the process. This is really staring at sandbox evasion. And then it would drop two VBScript files. So one would activate a action to add a Windows Defender exclusion, as well as create a scheduled task to kind of establish its persistence. And then the second one would launch a secondary payload launcher. And this one would contain a variance of three that were noted specifically. So you had the secondary payload would or could be the Scald Stealer. And that was brought in via Bitbucket. And mostly what that was looking for was targeting credentials, Discord tokens, and also stealing seed phrases from wallets. And it was all injected via JavaScript. And then you also would see or could see async rat, so remote access Trojan. We've talked about this one in the past. And then there is also the Chromecats based cookie stealer. So basically what this one does is it bypasses Chrome's ADE by injecting into browser memory using the K32 get module file name or the get file version info API calls. So these are some of the delivery pieces. And again, I already talked about the evasion and persistence techniques with the sandbox piece, but you also kind of see in this process some of the stealth attempts, you know, by using legitimate sites like GitHub, Bitbucket, Pastebin, et cetera, really to blend into that normal traffic and avoid any firewall, EV detection, things like that. The scheduled task, and make sure that the malware was running every 5 minutes. And if not, it would actually reset itself into persistence. So it seemed like the primary target here was more towards the crypto savvy side of the world. It didn't focus specifically on any one given area in the world, but around 1,300 repository downloads were tracked, and it does seem to stare at the financial motivation, because it really is targeting those crypto wallet seed harvest and other pieces for ransomware extortion. Some of the things in this weren't necessarily novel by any means. I think the use of the Discord link was interesting to me, Scott, because it was thought that you couldn't reuse these, but when they expired, you get that random code that generates in an invite. You can just take that and replay it into your own link by creating your own invite using that seed. So it was interesting that that was a technique that was used. But some of the threat hunt kind of sides of things, you know, these are things that we've talked about before, looking for that PowerShell command line arguments, you know, things like invoking web requests, the IEX calls for exclusions, things like that. There is some opportunity, I think, to kind of look at the Discord redirect flows and execution from that path. Also, you know, one that we beat to death and we always will, because it comes up so frequently, is monitoring for that add MP preference dash exclusion path kind of command line argument for that Defender evasion, Windows Defender evasion. And then also identifying scheduled VBScript tasks that you wouldn't necessarily see. We've talked about that before too, but I'll take a breath, Scott. What did you think about this one?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, and it's very clear that this is definitely fixable on the Discord side. You know, the biggest, I guess, weakness in the implementation to create those vanity links where you can basically make it whatever you want, as long as someone else doesn't already use the same like word or phrase or whatever, is they could combine what they do for the generic general links that expire, where they create like a token string. They could just do that as almost like the subdomain to the vanity, you know, like set up the pathing on the URL that way. Not subdomain, to be after, but you know, like /token/ whatever the vanity words you want to use. So that way, even if you wanted to create something that looked like it, you wouldn't be able to have any control over that token that preceded it. because that would be random on the Discord side. I mean, that would be an easy implementation. So hopefully they're looking at something like that. And I don't think it takes away from the functionality by doing that. But yeah, it's what I liked about this whole article, talking about, you know, the uses of how they had multiple stages of malware, rats, their use of click fix, the use of persistence and execution. It almost is all the techniques we've been talking about for weeks, right? But almost in an entire campaign. And like always, the biggest thing that changed was that initial access type piece, which is kind of why when I look at security, the initial access pieces are always really interesting to learn from, because they help you identify holes that you may be able to address and, you know, with certain controls, or, you know, maybe looking for them for unique campaign, for instance. But if you're already looking at kind of the meat of the attack already, which we, you know, we said like all these techniques, I want to say like identical in some aspects, even in from what, how the code looks, just from pulling from memory. So, you know, if you're looking for this similar things, this is easily identifiable. And not only that, but it's like interesting because I feel like it's the new techniques to get in. You know, we're seeing those evolve, but we're also kind of seeing almost like if it's the same group, they're kind of evolving and stitching together all these things that they were kind of almost, you know, trying and testing in different campaigns previously, and where they had success, it's like you can kind of see those, you know, exist in the next evolution of the attack. So you can kind of see that, you know, maturation or whatever you want to call it. So that part was really cool seeing it all called out. But yeah, a lot of the things that you called out, I think the only other thing that I didn't hear you mention, you may have said, was like I said before, I mean, they've got PowerShell executing W scripts as part of like a process chaining. Like we always talked about the script interpreter process chaining as just a big giveaway for a lot of these types of attacks on top of everything else that was mentioned. So yeah, no, it was a pretty interesting conglomeration. I like it.
Yeah, I did not mention that, Scott. Thank you. Yeah, but I think that's you hit it nail on the head. There's a playbook right now going around in the current like window of time that we're living in, and we're seeing it over and over again. Some of the pieces of the playbook, the framework of that playbook is pretty solid, and then they're just tweaking the various pieces for evolution. But yeah,
and you know, I remember when ClickFix kind of became the thing for a minute, right? I mean, it's still, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a thing, but it was like the topic of conversation amongst security people. Like, what are we gonna do with this? And what's crazy is, I feel like the conversation shouldn't have been around that. It should have been around what all the other activity around ClickFix in itself, you know, because now ClickFix is there, but there's so much activity surrounding it. It's almost like you don't necessarily need to know that was the part of the chain on the initial identification. You can discover that later. So, yeah.
Yep. I was going to force.
Yeah, it kind of segues into like that, what do you freak out about perspective. So I just kind of looked at some, you know, basic news articles this week. Nothing super technical, but so I was looking at Security Week, some of their articles or blogs, and there was the article, New Smart Attack Steals Air Gap Data Using Smartwatches. And basically to summarize this is there was a researcher, you know, it's academia, and he was trying to figure out how to potentially attack air gap systems or systems in general, and you know, with other types of technology. In this case, he was using a smartwatch. And the idea of the attack is you'd have to have gotten initial access to the air gap systems already. So you have a malware that is running there, and by using the computer speakers, is able to then produce super or ultrasonic signals that if someone then had a smartwatch that was also compromised or tied to this attack, the smartwatch's microphone could pick up on the ultrasonic signals and convert that signal to data and basically be able to successfully enable data theft. I mean, it's kind of like the spy movie, right? Stuff. And, you know, what I love about these types of things is it's just completely outside the box. Like, what can we do? Which is very valuable. But sometimes people read this and they immediately start freaking out and say, oh my gosh, we got to stop wearing smartwatches in our data centers or whatever it is in that case, Which is just funny because on its surface, like, that is not the point, right? So, you know, if your data center isn't air gaps and all the steps required, obviously you wouldn't care, because if they can put malware in the system and communicate out because it's not air gapped already, what's the point? And then when it comes to really, really super secure things, you should always be cognizant of what technology you're bringing around, whatever. To the point of, is it, it, and it might be an inconvenience, but just, you know, why bother? You don't have to necessarily have this to give you the idea that maybe we should just be a little more cognizant for something that we just want to protect as best as possible, with just best effort, even if you don't have the knowledge. So yeah, sometimes I like to see this research, but I also know, there's been plenty of research that's out there that has kind of changed in some of the standards of which we do certain things. And I feel like, yeah, you know, it's valid, but where's the circumstance where that's been, and no one wants to be the first victim, but, you know, the example of that is people freaking out about charging their phones in airports, right? Like, that was a theoretical attack, and it still probably could have happened or happened, but no one's been able to prove. And the amount of effort to try to get past like TSA and all sorts of security controls to get to an area where people would charge their phones just for that, and then have to figure out how to collect that in some way or whatever. I don't know. It's just interesting. I don't like to say things are impossible, but that's kind of the point. This proves things are possible, but you still have to be rational, I guess.
Yeah. I think the rational thing is the key, right? Because people do see this and freak out. I know we have both experienced that, especially among higher levels of leadership when they see these kinds of things. But it is possible, right? I remember us spending time years ago looking into, you know, specific ways that an air gap or a type of attack could occur in an air gapped area. And I remember we stumbled upon this. So when you kind of noted this one today, I had to go back and actually look, but we stumbled upon research that was done as an example of what is possible. But there was research done on the CRT monitors and how they would have like, what was it? The tubes inside of the CRT monitors would emit certain radiation levels, and they could be monitored to understand how data was being transmitted to the monitor. So you could actually steal data that way, completely air gapped. It was pretty interesting, right? And then we've seen other things where air gapped environments, you run into that human error, right? So like when you look, the very easy example, like somebody walks into an air gap place and they're like, oh yeah, I have this USB that I need to transfer this file to this air gap computer to do a thing, and then bam.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very interesting. Exactly. It's worth not freaking out about and just understanding, but it is still kind of cool to think about, because I think there should be space in our minds, especially as defenders, to consider those sub 1% type things, right? Like I think it's healthy for us because it keeps us on our toes and keeps us thinking about, you know, evolving technology and how to skirt it and things like that, just beyond the stuff that's constantly slapped in our face, right?
It just becomes like the exercise that like you should always approach almost everything to anything as possible, so you don't necessarily close a lot of doors or be closed minded. But decision making is still a skill, and you really have to exercise that muscle too to be able to take in other inputs beyond what is possible, right, to make good decisions. And that's kind of what I think what makes some of the better security professionals, you know, better security professionals, is they've exercised that muscle as well as their technical aptitude. So
cool. All right. So jumping into the next one I have this week. So this is an article out of AIM Security. It's titled Breaking Down the Echo Leak, which is dubbed the first zero-click AI vulnerability enabling data exfiltration from Microsoft 365 Copilot. So general overview here, attackers can exfiltrate sensitive Copilot context. So we're talking Mail, OneDrive, SharePoint, Teams, et cetera, without user interaction, simply by sending an email. It appears to be and is noted as the first weaponizable zero-click exploit targeting an AI agent, resulting in compromise of Copilot's data integrity. So, and Scott, you know, correct me if I stumble on some of this, because some of this read a little bit different to me. But the technical breakdown. So we're looking at RAG Copilot misuse. So Microsoft 365 Copilot uses RAG, which is retrieval augmented generation, pulling in external email content alongside internal data via Microsoft Graph. And the vulnerability arises because the LLM accepts untrusted instructions disguised as a benign email to access privileged context. So kind of walking down a little bit. So the way that it bypasses the Copilot guardrails is by phrasing the malicious content to appear as instructions to the user and not AI. So you have like this markdown link redaction. So it tricks Copilot by using reference style markdown text to leak data via an external link that isn't redacted. And it has like this image fetch trick that embeds secrets in the image URLs via reference style markdown to trigger automatic exfiltration without clicks. So basically circumventing those CSP filters. Again, I had to go through this about six times to make that. I think it makes sense to me. So hopefully if you need to correct me, go ahead and curt me a little bit here, because you might be a little bit upscale for me on this specific topic. So some of the operationalization tactics. So the RAG spraying is the thing that's tagged. So basically this sends multiple variant labeled emails or long chunked emails to increase retrieval probability, which leverages email embedding diversity. So the reference omission side is the malicious email can then instruct Copilot not to reference itself. So basically avoiding those like indicator traces, I think they're called.
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, it just seemed very interesting to me. This is less than a very direct technical, because I know what we're talking about here isn't something that I think we can actually hunt for at this point in time. But it was interesting to see that this vulnerability exists. Now, Microsoft has since corrected this, but it was very interesting to see this, the ability to do this true, to me at least, Scott, it seemed to be a truly non-click, zero-click type of thing. So I don't know. I'm going to take a break because it's a lot of, when I start talking AI, it gets a little deep and I want to try to get back to the surface. So what did you think?
Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting and, you know, I've been staring, they have this really great diagram that kind of plays the attack live sort of.
I left that for you because I thought you'd love that. I was going to say something, I had a note of it, but I'm like, let's see if Scott says it first. If he doesn't, I'll circle back. Wasn't that cool, man?
Yeah, no, I liked it because like but the thing was I had to stare. I'm still in front of me now because we're talking about it. But like, you know, I had to like stare at it like, okay, so what is essentially really happening here? And I understood why the attack happens, right? Because we're implementing all the like Copilot and other AIs to have access to everything in the ecosystem so that it can basically help you do everything you want or need to do, right? But it was interesting because I'm thinking about the problem, and it's the same problem like when we deal with sensitive anything, right? It's the same problem we have with why people don't implement DLP. And I don't know if these conditional controls exist in Copilot or AI, but they think they should. But if you're able to label your data or create conditional rules so that Copilot and these things maybe can't access certain things or only under certain conditions can it access certain things, like this problem just goes away. And not only that, but approaching it that way also potentially would solve future problems that could, like, that's the only thing I worry about is like, well, they fixed this specific problem. It's like, okay, so the attack itself is fixed, but the access and the data exposure could still exist in another manner, right? And what I mean by that is, you know, even if you can't, don't want to go through the exercise of labeling every single like document or file or whatever it is, I feel like you should be able to set up some sort of conditional access based on like, hey, if this is stuff that's sensitive, put it in this area or on this, you know, stored in these SharePoint sites, or this is the OneDrive directory or whatever. And this means Copilot is just, there's a rule that says Copilot can't touch things in here. Or maybe there's, if it touches things in here, you can approve it, right? Like there's something in the middle that pauses everything until there is some user interaction, you know, so to speak, so that there's no unknown access, for instance. So there's that aspect, right? And that's something I don't know if it exists today, but it sounds like a good control that should exist moving forward regardless, because, you know, you got Gemini and Google, and they have a whole ecosystem, right? You've got Copilot of Microsoft. I don't really know what Amazon specifically has. I don't think they have anything yet, but, you know, there's an ecosystem there. So anywhere there's like this giant ecosystem where things can be kind of co-shared and co-live or whatever, something to always consider. And then the other thing is, you know, we've always struggled from a security practitioner when it comes to data, right? And things that happen, a lot of these LLMs and back in AI, you know, dubbed AI systems, we don't really see a lot of the inner workings, but it would be very nice to see telemetry on what it touches or accesses, right? I don't think that is like an ask that is just too much to ask, I should say, right? Because if it's your data already, I want to know when stuff like that accesses my data, right? And then and kind of what it does with it, right? It should just be like, did it read this? Did it create something from, like, did it create files? Like, I think there should be something for that, because that's another thing, especially like you can create thresholds on maybe certain directories and things where, you know, sensitive data might be, or there's keywords or something like that. Like, there'd be something I think you should be able to do. And it'd be similar in my mind of like monitoring a file share. Like, it could be a lot of activity, right? But, you know, people collect those file share logs for the same exact reason. They want to know what's accessing what and what potentially, you know, could be read or whatnot as well. And I guess then that it brings up a third point I didn't actually think about until now, is most of the time when it comes to information, it's still tied to, does the user have access? So is Copilot in this instance impersonating the user is doing the action for, or does Copilot have its separate action? And what does that look like? Because I'm assuming the user is theoretically running Copilot, so that's under their access token, so to speak, but something else, like, should Copilot have its own kind of identity that you have to then manage in AD? I don't know. But yeah, so just a couple things on, like, I guess I'm trying to solution it a little bit, but I think if people are thinking about things and they agree with me and having those conversations, sometimes that can push vendors to implement stuff like that. So
yeah, and I'd like to see the I really personally hope that there's not some grandiose type style cyber attack on AI that really punches a hole in this whole, you know, innovation and evolution phase that we're in. Because, I mean, we're kind of in a bit of a like space race type thing that's like exponentially happening faster and at a wider scale. And, you know, to your point of the what is being accessed, I'd like to know also, like, can you tell me how it's being accessed? Like, just present that, right? And that communication happen. Because I think there is probably a lot more blind spots occurring in development phases with stuff like this, simply because of the need to get to market or to catch up to the next guy or just evolve with the technology as fast as it is. But yeah, cool to see.
And another system
happen.
Like how it's being accessed, stuff like that. Sometimes that stuff's not exposed for the same reason that worried some attackers going to figure out how to exploit it. But that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't, because that's how you kind of test it in a way, right? But yeah, no, I agree. Like, it's just all this stuff is great technologies. It's moving the mark, help making people think differently, which is, you know, I feel like we're kind of stagnant for a while. And I feel like that's why a lot of solutions just kind of look like other solutions. Solutions are starting to look different. I think this is, you know, partly because of this.
Yeah, agreed.
All right. So the next thing I want to talk about, it's just something that I feel like we should talk about, just because it is a big change overall. Like I said, I did more newsreeling type stuff to find things to discuss this week. So it is off of Security Week, another one of their articles in the government section, but it's industry reactions to Trump cybersecurity executive order, Feedback Friday. Essentially, if people haven't been following, there's been executive orders with every single administration in the United States, trying to provide guidance on what needs to happen in cybersecurity moving forward. I think there was Obama had one, and Biden signed and made some changes, and then now Trump has made some changes. And the big thing about the changes, depending on what space you operate in, they're significant and they're not, right? But I'll kind of try to explain why. Most of the time, or a lot of the stuff that I would say is staying consistent that didn't change, is post-quantum cryptography that's in there, still kind of the same. Yeah, we need to be looking at that BGP routing security. If anyone knows anything about BGP, it's kind of not the most secure, but yet the backbone of everything internet-wide. So better controls there to help stable, like prevent and keep that the internet backbone stable, essentially. IoT device labeling still kind of covered in there, and encryption upgrades in general, right? And because these are focuses everyone kind of understands that we don't want to make any changes to. We understand that they are things we should be paying attention to. But some of the biggest changes, and then I'll kind of talk through them a little bit, and then kind of give my two cents, and then, you know, Tom, then you can weigh in to see, like, am I crazy talk, or what other things you had to say based on the things that you hear from me. One was, there's kind of the rollback of mandatory software security attestations. And so what does that really mean? There was in their previous executive order where federal contractors and things, they were required to basically attest to all the security of their software, like the supply chain transparency. They also referred to some of these things called SBOMs, right? It's the software bill of materials. It's basically like a formal structured list of components that go into software, like, you know, libraries being used, modules being used, all the dependencies. So all the pieces that make up software. I think that's important because sometimes, like, the way we develop anyways, right? We're always using other people's libraries. And if you look at like the PyPI and the NPM package repositories that are getting compromised now all the time, or, you know, adjacent ones that are using typo squatting to get people compromised by using them. It just, obviously there's a potential threat there. The requirement for that has been removed. Now it's like, it's not really mandatory. It's more voluntary adoption. Obviously, I think if you're able to prove all that stuff out, maybe you look like a better contender if there's maybe government contracts or things involved. So that was a rollback there. So there was that change. And then there was the elimination of federal digital identity mandates. So what does that really mean? In the previous administration, there was a big push for, hey, we need to have verified digital identity across systems and authentication across federal agencies. Because as we know, working in security, passwords are not the most robust. And most, especially if you're working in cloud environments, your identity is pretty much the keys of the kingdom. So how you secure that identity is kind of important. So that push to like mandate that for better security for identities in general, it's kind of been scrapped a little bit. So there is that potentially can introduce some weaknesses, you know, moving forward or whatever, because there's not that oversight or mandate necessarily. Narrowing of cyber sanctions authority. This big thing was, there was the ability in the previous executive order that talked about, hey, if there are issues, that enables cyber threats, right, then there could be sanctions put on, anyone, right? So it used to be US-based firms as well as, foreign entities. Now it only applies to foreign entities. So there's just less teeth, I guess, if someone develops things poorly, then there's nothing to really kind of hold them accountable if they were to introduce a major cyber shift. And then there's a shift from the top-down mandates for voluntary frameworks. So basically, for mandates for better software development, so NIST, they're still promoting, like, they want NIST to push out the security software development framework and make that more robust. Kind of make it a standard, but even though they're pushing that to kind of help people build better software, they're not requiring adoption of it, which is interesting because, you know, I was exposed to NIST. NIST is a great framework in a lot of areas and it covers a lot of things. and you talk to people who use it, and it seems like shops that usually are newer, sometimes they're more like pro to like, I'm going to adopt this because it's easy, it's laid out, people know about it, so forth. And then sometimes you run into bigger, more mature shops, and this is just, you know, they know of it, but that's not how they run their shop. And I feel like depending on the size of things, that'll be kind of the same focus for the software development side. And then NIST, the big change is they were supposed to be kind of in helping to enforce rules. Now they're more tasked with updating guidance. So providing more guidance and not necessarily the enforcement tied to some of those things. So it's more like a facilitator of best practice, not a, like a regulatory body, which, you know, it depends on how you look at regulation. But it's kind of the same thing. If there's no teeth, what does that mean? And then there's also the removal of zero trust architecture deadlines. There were deadlines to try to implement zero trust across multiple federal agencies. It's kind of being eliminated. So now it's more, not necessarily eliminated, I should say. It's more adopt at your own pace. Right. So in some aspects, you know, depending on where you're dealing with, that makes sense. Sometimes it's really hard to adopt zero trust and require a huge investment if you're going to change out technologies and things like that. So those are like the big differences. But the thing I think we should really be focused on is there was a huge, in the article, there was like pushbacks from both sides, right? There was like, well, we like this because we want more freedom, and we need to focus more on how we develop things to be more secure, versus people saying, well, we need to be able to enforce things to be more secure, and all those types of focuses. But I think it's what we always run into. Depending on who you talk to and what they're passionate about, they're going to give you one or other guidance. But I really feel like it should be more of a hybrid approach, right? Because there might be some areas where you need to have more enforcement. Like obviously the people or the companies or vendors, whatever, that have more resources can invest better in some of those things. And then the things that don't can't invest in some of those things. So that was kind of like the big thing for me was, you know, maybe certain sectors or certain areas don't need the same requirements as all. And that's kind of what kind of hurts us when we go one direction or the other. It's kind of like that pendulum swing on some of these things. I like some of the changes because I understand why they're being changed, but I don't see the need to remove certain things. I feel like we should be really looking at things based on, you know, where we're trying to apply it, like more of a hybrid approach based on criticality and risk. And that's how we should be basically adopting some of these things based on our perceived risk and not just general guidance. I don't know if I rambled enough about that, but that was kind of my approach. I'll stop there to see kind of what your takeaway on some of the things I said, or if you have some additional things to even add to that.
Yeah. So when I was reading this, part of me, half of my head, if you can imagine, had tinfoil hat on. So I'm going to take that off. Now I'm gonna set this over here to the side. I'm not gonna tinfoil hat. I find it, I don't understand the direction to kind of remove that worrying piece when we're talking about the only focusing on foreign adversaries or foreign peoples. I think it isn't specifically says persons against foreign persons rather than any person. I don't understand that move. I'm not quite sure. There are some things here that like I get. I like to see the thought process of considering the possibilities that will come as quantum computing expands, right? I think there's levels of like science fiction thinking, and there's levels of reality that haven't yet found their strands in this specific topic, at least to my knowledge. So I like the idea of thinking that way and thinking forward that way. Okay. So one specific piece, cause I kind of wouldn't mind your feedback on this one, Scott. One of the things that it talks about or, you know, kind of looks at is the whole idea around digital identity stuff, right? This has always been a thing that I've danced with in my head, and people that I know have asked me about this, and I've had conversations about it. We live in a world that it should be a phase that we move to, right? A digital identity. We have the technology, and let's put the quantum computing thing aside, or the potential to be able to break the cryptography's capabilities that we have now. So let's set that to the side. So putting that aside, we have the technology to do this, and we in theory could do this in a much more secure fashion as far as people's personal identification pieces and documents and things like that. However, we talk constantly about how the development, the deployment, you know, you're putting the responsibility of this into a third party's hands kind of thing. And there's layers of that anyway, even with physical documents, but still, it's hard to feel like we have shown the ability to be able to do this successfully, even though all of the pieces, all the Lego blocks are there to put that thing together. So I tend to dance back and forth on that specific piece with the digital identity thing. So I'm finding myself teetering on that specific bullet point in this whole thing. Do you get what I'm saying?
So
I want to say we should have that because it would make so much more seamless. We would avoid a lot of fraud in theory. A lot of different things could be corrected with that. However, I feel like you could also, if not done right, open a much larger Pandora's box. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. So one of the points I was trying to figure out, like I had it in my head before when I was looking at some of the stuff and you kind of brought it back to the surface. And it's kind of along the lines of what you're talking about. I was like, we have the technology. Why don't we just do the things the right way? And that kind of approach, and it solves a lot of these problems, even depending on whoever we trust. And I think it's the problem when you have people in administrations in general that just don't understand the problem, and they understand almost the Hollywood part of it, where it's like, the reason why we have threats is because we have adversaries, and they're not thinking about the problem the right way, where if we just build things the right way, a lot of those problems go away, right? So I feel like the mandates and the changes and make certain things enforceable is kind of why compliance and stuff exists, which a lot of people hate too. But by doing certain things like that, it forces kind of people to build and implement things. So not all the onus is on the defender. It's on the developer and the builder as well. And I know that there was a big push to say, let's build out the secure software development framework so people can build things better and have something to reference. But having something to reference, let's be honest, doesn't necessarily mean it'll happen. And I know that from just going through computer science, and I know every computer science program at universities can be very different, but there was never a focus on coding securely. It was on, can we teach you how to code? So just that at a fundamental basis, good programmers sometimes aren't the best security programmers, and they have to learn that almost on the job, right? Or through experience, or through just caring enough. I don't even think there was a secure coding class available. There was just some anecdotal, this is why this exists. Okay, cool. Do we need to do it that way? No. Okay. So just knowing that maybe, our people who develop aren't getting taught how to do secure coding naturally as they're learning the skill, on top of having a framework be voluntary, I feel like we'll just continue to kick the can a little bit. But what I really want to see is where we understand that the problem is something that in most cases is self-created. So if we do a better on design and development, then to be a security practitioner, now you can worry about the security things you can worry about a subset of security things, right? Not like when we talked about the smartwatch that can steal information from an air gap network, where you have to basically account for all possible things, right? Basically, I think the biggest driver is understanding how to apply things better and knowing that there are hard requirements for things that need to be more secure. Like if you focus on just government, you've got nuclear programs, right? I wouldn't expect any leniency there versus like the post office, which may have some critical things. I know there's some critical things tied to it, but those areas can potentially have more lax, and having broad swath decision-making across the board, I don't think is the best approach. There is an kind of an
art and a skill to this, I think it's good to offer guidelines and saying, these are things that we need to implement. And these are, you know, how we're going to try to keep things accountable. But there's got to be something else deciding, well, where are those places as well? So that's kind of my thought on the whole risk approach to kind of providing these solutions. And I don't know if you heard me before, but I went to an institution when we learned computer science. We didn't learn how to develop code securely. We just learned how to develop code. Security was not taught. So if it's something that's not taught in the ground up, and people have to learn that through experience, just having better frameworks and guidelines for how you do things more securely, it's just going to be really, like, that's a lot of extra work for somebody that's not just natively doing it. So there's other places that could be fixed too, but that's a whole nother set of problems there.
Yeah, I think above all, just my last two cents on this whole thing, I think it echoes such an important statement to the times that we live in, that we need to be investing in these kinds of things. We need to be investing monetarily. We need to be investing with our time, with collaboration, developing tools that can help us streamline this stuff, kind of keep pace with the development life cycle. These are challenges that we've always faced, right? Like working across the aisle with people who are coding and people who are focused on security, and it's just evolving and the technology is outpacing all of us, right? I think now it just speaks more than anything. And this kind of references that point, you know, with things on the horizon, like quantum computing, with the evolution of AI, with the ability to develop tool sets, like we've talked about in the past, that can make attackers streamline going after their targets and their campaigns. We need to invest in this, like around the board. We need to invest in not security as a whole in general, but in the creating bridges across the gap to make sure that we are developing safely and securely. We are considering future events. You know, we are in some room thinking about that 0.1% chance that a smartwatch could get something, like all of the things. So like that, you know, long-winded last two cents, but we got to invest in developing these, the ability to bridge these gaps.
Yeah. And I'm hoping that maybe NIST, when they talk about their secure software development, that in that framework, they have that, at least a baseline of things. If you build something, it needs to have these capabilities, this type of visibility it can produce. And, you know, uses like the standard minimum of X as far as like when it comes to what encryptions you use and all that kind of stuff, right? I just feel like those things I think can be enforceable, but then you should be kind of almost, I wouldn't say congratulated, but there should be some benefits to going beyond that too, right? That's how you incentivize growth and change. So, yeah. Agreed. So, yeah, with that, I feel like that long discussion kind of closes out this week's Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. So before we close out, I want to mention we have a Threat Hunting Management Workshop. It's all about structuring collaboration across teams. It's going to be happening tomorrow, but if you don't hear this and do enough time, make sure to catch the recording. It should be an interesting conversation. I'm leading that one. And then we also have our up and coming live Out of the Woods podcast episode called The Intersection of AI and Threat Hunting. What problems emerge and what problems get solved? So we're just going to beat that one to death, hopefully, with all sorts of what does AI bring to the table and how we use it, how it affects us, and how it creates problems and all of the above. So check that out on July 10th from 12 to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of June 17th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.